Hello and welcome to Fire Science Show, session 25. Nice to have you here again. When I've started this podcast, I've set myself a goal to reach episode 25 and see what happens. And yeah, what happened is 10,000 downloads, a huge feedback from all over the world, a lot of happy listeners and growing audience that seems very healthy. So I guess there's no other option but continue to go with this. I hope my today's episode does not discourage you from following the podcast, because today I have some real fire science without taking hostages. We're going to talk about some serious structural fire engineering, but on a topic that seems to be the most interesting because it's structural fire resistance of engineered timber. So a word of warning, if you're not a structural fire engineer, it's going to be probably a bit tough. And I had the same, it's some difficult concepts being presented. But precisely that was the point of making this episode, to show you the complexity of the problem, to show you what things go into engineering mass timber structure, so it truly resists fire. So the next time you see a stupid LinkedIn post about wood being stronger than steel, or the fact that a layer of char is better at protecting timber than mineral wool or something, you will know how to react, and you will know that it's not a whole story. There's many more aspects to the story that are very important, and that these details make a true difference when it comes to the structure sustaining a huge fire. It is also, in a way, a follow-up to an episode with Danny Hopkin, who shown us the world of mass timber and engineered timber. And we've talked a lot about compartment fire dynamics and overall aspects of why we should build with timber and how to make timber fire safe. Today we go more into the structural fire resistance of the engineered timber. Today we go a bit into the chemistry of adhesives. And yeah, I think you're going to like it a lot, even if you're not a structural engineer. I've certainly enjoyed it. My today's guest has done his PhD on the subject. He's spurned a lot of timber structures, first at the University of Edinburgh, now in the University of Queensland. And he's now involved in building the National Centre for Timber Durability and Design Life in Australia, which is super interesting project, and you're going to hear a bit about that. So yeah, please help me welcoming Dr. Felix Weissner from University of Queensland, and yeah, let's spin the intro and jump into the episode. Welcome to the Fire Science Show. My name is Wojciech Wigrzyński, and I will be your host. Hello and welcome to Fire Science Show. Today I'm with Felix Weissner from University of Queensland. Hi, Felix.
Hi, thank you for inviting me. Happy to be here.
I'm really happy to have you here. It seems you're researching the subject that's most interesting for my podcast audience based on statistics, and that is timber in fire, or structural fire resistance of wood. As you know, some weeks ago I had Danny Hopkin when we discussed a lot of aspects of fire safety in timber buildings and how this could be introduced. But I have so many more questions, especially to the structural side, so I'm really happy to have you today to answer me all of these pending issues. So before we jump into the structural fire resistance, I have a cheesy question to ask. How sustainable is a building that burned down completely?
Depends. When does it burn down? If you say 40 years into the design life, you probably hit a point where you hit sustainability zero, and from then you can only gain onwards. But one issue with timber buildings is that most of the accidents we have seen happen in the construction phase. I think it was University of Nottingham that built their new chemistry building that was a mix of stick frame and mass timber. And it burned down during construction, and it still won a sustainability award when it was finished. So question then is maybe how often can it burn down and still be sustainable?
I've asked that because timber is obviously the technology marketed as green, as sustainable, as climate friendly, planet friendly, which obviously is true as long as the building is built, completed, sustains its whole life. And I think with mass timber buildings or engineered timber buildings, we're not really questioning the structural capability. Maybe we are in a bit, but not very hardly. We're not questioning the ability to build these buildings, but we're worried about, will they survive their lifetime? And if a fire event happens in such a building, what will be the consequences?
Yeah, and I mean, you would have the same issue for any sort of building, because even in a steel or concrete building, if you have a fire that you cannot control and then moves from compartment to compartment, eventually you will lose so much of the building that it might be too expensive to reconstruct it. Mm. I think it also boils down a bit to the concept of fire resistance and how it's applied, because a lot of people interpret fire resistance, let's say 90 minutes, and they say, okay, after 90 minutes, we can wash our hands and whatever happens, happens. But obviously the original concept of fire resistance was maintain the structural capacity until you get burnout of the original fuel load. And then the fire goes out by its own and the building is saved. Maybe the concept how it's applied now, that a lot of structure engineers, when you talk to them, they seem to have the idea that, okay, after 90 minutes, as long as everyone out, it can collapse and that's all good. But if you think about the timber buildings we're building, even if you think about five stories, would it be acceptable to have a five-story building in a major city collapse from a fire? I mean, even if everyone gets out, even if we can perfectly anticipate it and control fire spread to the neighboring buildings, in terms of property protection, that should be a big deal.
We had a fire of a car park in Warsaw a year ago, like almost exactly a year ago. A very large car park fire that literally led to significant structural damage to the car park. And it was a residential building, I think 80-something apartments in that building. And these people have not came back to that building ever yet. Maybe they will, because they're trying to save the building. But it's horrible. A fire that takes down a living place, and you don't want that. I don't think it's acceptable that a fire, you know, and I'm not talking about a fire where someone would have a barrel of oil in his compartment and cause an accident. I'm talking about a very common fire. A car fire in a car park is a common fire. That's a common scenario, which you would very, very expect. The same like a kitchen fire in a house or some electrical appliance fire in your house. And these are scenarios that are normal to be considered, but yet in case of timber or mass timber buildings, especially if you have a lot of exposed wood products, the compartment fire dynamics of that fire could be completely different than compartment fire dynamics from, let's say, a non-combustible compartment. And what you've said, that the structural material will add to the fuel load, is now a new factor that you have to consider, right?
Yeah, I mean, it again goes back to the burnout question. I think when Danny was on your show, he discussed that quite a bit and highlighted very much the problems with that. But I think also just in what you just said touches on one of the issues in fire safety, is the economic factor. When you said, yeah, you had 80 families living in that building and they cannot return. And looking at some of the origins of fire safety regulation, they were often driven by economics. If you look at the Great Fire of London afterwards, they changed all of the building regulations in the United Kingdom, that people died in that fire. But the main driver for these changes was that basically the British economy, or at that point the English economy, went bust for a couple of months or even years, and the enormous cost to recover that. That's an important aspect. And also in terms of buildings after fires and the effect of fire, sometimes you talk to people and they make that point that actually in a timber building, when you have a fire, it's easier to rebuild because everything turns to ash. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if they're being serious or if they're being flippant. It's obviously a serious topic that we should discuss. And I think maybe for one-story or two-story house in the middle of nowhere, that makes sense. But again, once you get people's living space, people's property involved, it has real life consequences beyond the fire on people's livelihoods.
Cost to recover, that's a nice phrase. I've written it down. That's, I think, a great measure of resilience of a building. So let's move on to the structural aspects of timber. First, timber has always been there. Like it's always been used as a structural material. However, it comes into this new phase where it's coined as the material of the future. And tell me, how is it different today than, let's say, 50 years ago or 100 years ago? Why 100 years ago we didn't build these large buildings of wood? We obviously did some. In Japan, there's massive infrastructure, castles and stuff like that built with timber. But it has not been, let's say, mainstream. Or you don't see them in your old town districts, these huge, huge wooden buildings. Tell me how it's different today.
Yeah, I mean, the why is probably that at some point you're just running out of large timber. Because in the past, before we used engineered timber, you were limited in your structural member size by the trees you could find. And obviously, there's only so many massive trees you can chop down to build your buildings. And now we have engineered timber, which has the advantage of you can take a lot of smaller trees and combine them into a building, a structural element that can be as big as you want, or any shape you can imagine almost now with looking at modern CNC and how we can shape buildings in a manufacturing process. So that has really opened a lot of opportunities of going higher and bigger with timber buildings.
And in terms of structural performance, what are the benefits of this engineered timber?
I mean, you can control better. Again, if you think about you look for a big tree and then you have to work with what you have there. Well, if you take a tree and you chop it up into smaller pieces, and then you can combine those and you have more reliability and confidence in your structural properties of the end product. So that helps you with the design. Another thing that is changing, that is not necessarily related to engineered timber, but also looking into the forestry sector, people are improving wood, the raw base material on the tree through selective breeding. After a few cycles of growth and felling trees, they pick the best ones and eventually they improve the elastic modulus by 10% in 20 years or something like that. Don't quote me on those numbers, but it's remarkably high. So that's obviously something where the base material changes. And also with engineered timber, it is engineered so we can select what we need. And now people are also looking to hardwoods to be included in engineered timber products, which again opens new opportunities to design your structural element as you need them for your building.
There's one colleague in my office, Dr. Paweł Sulik, and he's researching the temperature response of CLT samples built from combinations of like all species available in Poland, you know, mixing them together, hardwoods, softwoods, all types of wood to figure out what are the differences between these combinations. So we don't necessarily rely on this one type of wood that comes from abroad that is the base of the CLT industry, and you could like do it more locally, which is always also something that improves the sustainability of this product. So I think that's a great direction.
Absolutely. It's a really great and exciting direction because it helps you to utilize local products that previously might have been underutilized, and you can use now species in CLT that previously would maybe not have been considered for structural applications. So it's really about making the most of what we have, and that's one of the key aspects we need to consider if we want to increase the sustainability.
And when you build these complex shapes of this engineered wood, to what extent you would engineer? Is it just a product and you cut it into that, or you would pick particular layer sizes, I don't know, adhesives. Is that also a part of this engineering, and that's done by the manufacturer, or who decides how to build the CLT slab?
I think the main input is probably from the manufacturer, and they will have some idea of what the market wants. I mean, obviously, if you look at a building, you could go into real depth and say, okay, I want this member to be a free layer from this species with this adhesive. And here I want something different. But actually, at the moment, the way the timber industry is set up, you would probably increase the cost because in timber, the way it's, or at least if you look at engineered timber, and the most popular product is probably cross-laminated timber, and at least in terms of volume, the cost is really about reconfiguring the factory where it's produced. So they really want like a standard product that comes out. Like they don't want to have too many changes, and it would really save money if you have like a few standard sizes. Then the next consideration, you can use your species of wood, which might be local availability or desirable properties. You can change the thickness of the different lamellas that make up your wood. Then you can decide on the adhesive, which there are certain cost considerations, there are health considerations from the gases that are offset from the adhesive as it cures and in the lifetime of the timber. And then there's obviously the fire safety, which in the last few years has become quite prominent for adhesives. And all of these things combine to form the product, and that will have a certain fire performance. And one of the things I've done for my PhD is look at how do these factors influence the end product. Mm-hmm. And it is quite interesting that in my PhD, when we changed from a 3-ply to a 5-ply, and we also changed the adhesive from a polyurethane to melamine urea formaldehyde adhesive, we increased the load-bearing capacity under the same heat exposure by 100% for some samples. So under the same equivalent load.
And the same like width of the element?
The same overall width. So it was 100 millimeter thickness. The 3-ply were 40-20-40, and the 5-ply were 5x20. So both are 100 millimeters thick. And in theory, the 40-20-40 is the one with the higher structural capacity because it has all the parallel strong layers on the outside, which, if you know a bit about structural engineering, that's where you want your material. That's why an I-beam looks like an I-beam. But then in fire, the 5-plies perform much better because they have less shear forces. You don't put all your eggs in one basket because once you burn through the first load-bearing layer, you hit that first crosswise layer after 20 mil, and that buys you some time before you get to the next load-bearing layer of under 40 mil. You just keep burning through half your load-bearing capacity, and if you consider how the neutral axis changes, you're really rapidly eating away at your bearing capacity.
When I'm designing a steel structure, it's usually a very simple analysis to find, you know, an encapsulation that will give me this temperature on the steel. Or when you design concrete, it's the magical layer that will prevent my rebar reaching certain temperature. But here it seems fairly complicated to have this.
It's interesting that you mentioned a magical number for concrete, because we got the same thing for timber, and it's the zero strength layer concept, which basically means you take your char depth that you get from your charring rate, which you either measure after a test or you assume a certain charring rate that we have from empirical observation and measurements. And then in the 80s, Schaffer in the US did a test and a lot of simulations on Cleland beams, and he determined that the load-bearing capacity in bending can then be back-calculated by taking off an extra layer of 7 millimeter, which basically lumps all the heat losses from heated timber below the char layer into 7 millimeter. You basically assume it's zero in the 7 millimeter, and then everything below that is at ultimate capacity. So you also have that magic number. The problem with that is that was for Cleland, for a limited set of Cleland beams. And like we just discussed, we now have all these exciting products with different pieces of timber, different adhesives. There's a lot of innovation. And the problem with that 7 millimeter is that we found with CLT, it doesn't really apply. You need much more than that. And obviously, there is a point to have these simple values that give you simple solutions, but you shouldn't apply it to a complex problem. If you have a Cleland beam and a simple structure, fine. If you design the largest timber building in the world, that is by definition a novel and complex structure, you probably shouldn't use that simple method. You should try to understand the behavior of the system and then come up with engineering solutions. These are like two different ways. This is one thing where I struggle a bit with fire resistance testing, because yes, it gives you an answer. It gives you a certain safety, but I guess Danny touched upon that as well, that the time fire resistance in a timber building, if you consider the fire dynamics, doesn't mean that much. And also it hinders understanding. So again, if you look, for example, at your colleague that you mentioned and they're working on different CLT, if they put out a new product, they need to put it through a fire resistance test. And a fire resistance test is very expensive. So instead, we need to complement these tests with research to understand how these systems go together and what the ultimate outcome for the structural fire resistance is. Because then we can tweak the product to a point where we can say, okay, now I'm confident that I have a safe product.
We have one of the biggest fire labs in Europe. So let's say we're cheating in the department of costs of fire testing at our side. But I understand that one lab is not enough to solve the issues of the future. You've mentioned the research on the charring layer, or the protective layer, was done on Cleland beams. But a stupid question, does it extend to us also to like columns or slabs or walls? Like, can you extrapolate that?
Yeah, I mean, the charring rate of wood shouldn't change that much. I mean, obviously, the fire dynamics change a bit whether you have a timber piece that's horizontal or vertical, just in terms of buoyancy and the lamina flame. But still, the charring rate shouldn't change that much. But one thing that changes is the stress distribution that you see and the effect of heat on that stress. And to be honest, I don't really care that much about the charring rate. There's so much research out there. There's a lot of numbers. We're getting quite good at getting that right. And once timber is charred, it has negligible strength and stiffness. So you can, if you take just a piece of charcoal, I can easily squeeze that in my hand. And that shows you there's left there to resist loads. What's interesting is what happens below the char, and that is where that 7mm zero strength layer, or now we're working on adjusted zero strength layers, come into play. And to answer your question about the difference between a beam and a column is that timber is affected differently in compression than it is in tension. So in beam, we have bending, and the tensile side is what is affected. In a column, we have mainly compression. One thing that changes is that in compression, the failure mode is compressive yielding. So it's a plastic deformation. And the heat-induced changes are more severe. That is not only a thing we need to consider in terms of the temperature. Another very important point is moisture. Because if you have perfectly dry timber and you can heat it to 70, 80 degrees, it won't change much in terms of the structural capacity. But if you take a piece of timber that's very wet and moist, and even at ambient temperatures will be much weaker than a dry piece of timber. And what happens is, in a fire, is that, I mean, most timber in a building situation will have about 10% moisture content. That's water that's in the timber. On a fire, that will, some of the water will go into your compartment and evaporate, but part of the water will drive deeper into the timber away from the heat because you're creating a pressure zone. That water can then accumulate and can really weaken the timber deeper inside. And so, for example, if you think about a column that's exposed from all sides, somehow the water like drives in and gathers somewhere, either in the core or if you have connections, it will accumulate at the connections because it can turn into vapor and then travel through the timber and will condense on surfaces. That's if you really work, if you get timber and you load it and then you start heating it, you'll see that water will travel to where you have metal connections and where it eventually it accumulates and can't escape. And when it accumulates there, the timber gets really soggy and then it's really easy to actually break it.
It's kind of, you know, a very abstract concept that exposing something to fire creates this water moving around. I would say it's very difficult to imagine, but then I remember when we're in the lab doing concrete slab tests. And whenever you do a concrete slab fire resistance test and you heat up the concrete, you end up with a puddle of water on the top of it. So I have this image in my head that I can relate to. And it's something really interesting that this, let's say, moisture ecosystem within your structural element would have this big impact. And in terms of engineered products like CLT, will this also be important for, let's say, interlayer bonds? Or just the connections to the other structures?
Measuring the movement of moisture is actually really tricky. You can infer the moisture content from the conductivity and the resistivity, but because it works on a logarithmic scale, you run into trouble at very high moisture contents. And really, if you think about a waterfront moving, you're talking about 100%. Mm. And it is definitely an issue for the interlayer bonds because we know that adhesive is weakened by elevated temperatures, but a lot of adhesive types are also weakened by elevated moisture contents. Some tests in the past have also shown that the biggest reduction comes from hot steam on adhesive. So basically water that is vaporized and hot enough to travel. And when that hits your bond layer, that will weaken your composite action. And I think Danny touched upon the concept of char falloff and the bond line integrity, and that is often considered in terms of the fire dynamics. And that's very important because if we get that and we cannot extinguish the fire does not extinguish itself, then we don't need to talk about the structural capacity because if we have a fire that never goes out, then we can design the strongest structure in the world. Eventually, you burn through. But obviously, if you get to the point where you design your fire dynamics right and you get the fire out, you still have to consider that in that time frame, your structure needs to remain standing, and afterwards it needs to remain standing. And to do that, we need to consider the effect of temperature and moisture movements on the timber and on the glue that holds the timber together, because we said in the beginning that you have all these layers and you create this beautiful engineered timber. If you take away the glue that holds it together, you suddenly have a bunch of timber boards and they behave differently because they don't have the composite action.
And is there a weak spot? Like, would that adhesive line would be the weakest spot? I had this episode with Ali Ashrafi and he was talking about structural resilience. And an important part of that was not just the fact that the structure will not collapse. It may collapse, but to give a fairly long warning and to not have this collapse as a very sudden action, because that can trap people. Is there a sudden failure mechanism for engineered timber products in fire, or it's more like degrading over time?
I would say it's degrading over time. Timber itself is brittle, at least in tension, and it can fail quite explosively. I had a timber piece I tested in the lab, and it snapped in half due to buckling, which was very loud and frankly a bit scary. But in fire, because you slowly get a deterioration, the slow increase in temperature, you will see deflections that increase, hopefully, before you get the failure. So you have some warning. The individual failure mode of the adhesive depends on the adhesive type, depends on the temperature, but I wouldn't imagine that you suddenly see a piece of timber where suddenly all the adhesive is gone. And even if you slowly lose the adhesive over time, that will then slowly reduce your composite action, which reduces your overall second area of modulus, and that will increase deflections. You do get some warning, I think, but then ultimately it will also depend on how is your structure designed, how are your connections designed to give you some redundancy there. Because if you just have simply supported elements that are screwed together, then when you get to the point of failure, you either get the tensile failure or the yield failure of the compression, which if you don't have redundancy, will progress very quickly to collapse.
I must say that image of this, let's say, glue line failure painted in my head was there will be like whole planks of wood falling down from the ceiling as soon as the glue is heated up. And that was what I thought it will be and how I imagined this, because it was brought as a very serious issue in the community. And then I've done these experiments with OFR, Danny, and then Structural Timber Alliance, and we've pushed a slab to the lamination mode where it was heated for a long, long period of time. So we had this glue line failure multiple times, actually. And it was not really this spectacular failure of the whole timber element. It was not that a plank would fall down and then I would have virgin wood exposed. But I could describe it best as a rain of charcoal, these small charcoal elements falling down. Sometimes there was a slightly larger element, but I've never seen a single plank fall down at one time. For me, it was surprising how well this product remains, like its integrity in terms of having these planks attached to each other only through the glue. And I must say, it was also a loaded element. It was not just a slab that was standing there. What's your experience, because you've tested so many of these adhesive types, what's your experience with this glue line failure?
People discuss about the different terminology. Some people call it char fall off. Some people say delamination. Some people say debonding. So there's still a lot of discussion about the correct terminology. Usually what you see, it depends when the sort of glue line integrity failure happens. If your outer layer, the first layer to the glue line, has already completely charred, then what happens is the char will fall off. And as we said earlier, that doesn't have structural consequences because you've already lost all the strength and stiffness in that.
Okay.
The other thing that can happen is when you still have a bit of timber and that starts to delaminate. So basically you have a timber piece that's partially charred, but at the bond line it's still timber and it starts to weaken there. But the problem there is then not that the whole plank will fall off. In my opinion, the problem happens much earlier, because if you get to that stage where it separates, you get to a stage where the bonding quality reduces. And actually in tests that we have back at the University of Edinburgh, We loaded beams and we heated not to fire temperatures, but in a heating chamber up to 150 degrees. And we saw that one adhesive type deflected much more, but we couldn't see it visually. So we couldn't make out any falling off or any separation of the layers, but there was clearly a difference because the only difference in these two products was the adhesive. And that's really interesting because it means that deterioration of the glue happens much earlier before you see these problems of sharp fall off and delamination, and it has structural consequences. I mean, eventually we saw something in terms of looking at it from the digital image correlation, where you look at like each image every few seconds and you measure the deformation. So you'll see, you can use that to calculate your shear strains, and you'll see that in an adhesive that weakens, the strains will be concentrated in the glue line instead of in the timber, because you'll see some deformation that you might not see visually, but you catch it by really slowing down the process by going image by image, frame by frame.
And it was done on what type of element? Beams, slabs?
I mean, we've seen that for beams. That was beams that were constantly loaded and then heated. But similarly, we've done wall strips where we used, that was with higher temperatures, so we used proper fire temperatures. So we used a radiant panel with 50 kilowatts per meter squared on the surface of the timber. And in that case, we also saw that the deflections that we measured increased for one type of adhesive way before we even saw char fall off. If we tested that with reduced heat flux, we eventually got char fall off before we reached the structural failure. But at the high heat flux, we actually saw structural failure before the char falls off. That is an issue, because even if you can prevent the char fall off and therefore solve your fire dynamics problem, the glue might still be weaker. And that's the case where I said earlier, actually, by thinking about that, you can increase your structural fire performance and thereby your fire resistance simply by making the right choices in your product design. Obviously, it's informed by more than fire safety. If one of them is 100 times more expensive, there's no point of choosing that, because you would make the product non-competitive. Or if you put a chemical on the adhesive that turns out causes cancer. So these are all considerations that need to be considered holistically in the design of both the product of timber and the building itself.
So when this structure element is exposed to fire, first, it will lose some of its structural capabilities by simply reducing the cross section, because you lose some wood. Then you would have this moisture traveling through the element that could impact the virgin wood inside the element or softer spots. Then you start getting heat, not only moisture, but also heat near the glue line, where it might affect the ability of that glue to transfer loads and in overall impact the load bearing of the whole element. And then this delamination process or char fall off, debonding, whatever you call it, it seems like the final act, you know, where everything has already happened to your element, and it, in this particular location of your cross section, it does not have any load bearing capacity anyway, and it just falls off as last suicidal act in this theater. Did I get it right?
Yeah, kind of. Although, like I said, the important bit is that the structural capacity of the glue line, and therefore the loss of composite action, happens much earlier. Like as soon as you start heating that glue line, you might already see losses. And like you said, the char fall off is then the final symptom of that disease. So that's when your patient dies, but obviously the illness started much earlier and various symptoms that lead to...
We're in the show business. You have to throw some fancy metaphors here. Fire show business. Where are we with our modeling capabilities? Like, I'm a structural engineer. I would like to model my structure. Can I take all of these things into account, or my models today are not fit to do that?
I mean, it depends on how comfortable you are with using standards, because the standards give you some calculation methods like the zero strength layer, but they don't really account for the glue effect on the structure yet. So then you have to make a choice. Mm-hmm. What do I know about my adhesive? Do I know that it weakens in fire, that it shows that? If yes, I have to decide how much. If I want to be on the safe side, I can say like, okay, when it heats, I can bout it and say, okay, I say at this point, all composite action is lost. And the ideal other cases are glue that doesn't lose any capacity and behaves like solid timber of the same thickness. And the reality is probably somewhere in between. So right now, we probably just have these two bounds.
In practical engineering, is this something that, for example, a structural engineering designing the biggest world timber building should really play, or they should just rely on the manufactured data with some margin of safety and they'll be good? Because it seems, if you take a look at the history of fire safety engineering, there were many great models, methods, softwares introduced, but in the end, it's always the magic numbers that make the greatest career of them all. So to what extent can a simple structural engineer design or affect that if in the end they just get the product from a factory that's very hard to change the way how it builds the product?
I think one of the key aspects of any engineering, of structural engineering, civil engineering education, should be engineering ethics. And part of that is knowing your limits. So if I'm not a mechanical engineer, and if someone tells me, design this elevator, I will probably say, this is not my expertise, and I will go and find a mechanical engineer to help me with that. And so the question is, if you are a structural engineer and you work on a simple building somewhere, you're probably okay using standardized guidance or following the manufacturer's recommendations, because the consequences in a fire, if it's a one or two-story CLT, a house somewhere, as long as you can guarantee that the flames don't spread to the neighboring properties, you get everyone out, it's probably fine. But then if you work on the biggest timber building in the world and you're a structure engineer and you're saying like, oh, here's this simple formulation, should I use this? You should probably think again and ask the building developer, can we get some money to hire a structural fire engineer who has this expertise? And then and then they can work with models, they can question the magic numbers, they can, maybe the magic number will work, but it's really about, if you design a extraordinary building, it's about demonstrating understanding. And really also, I assume if you work on a fancy prestige building, you get paid big monies, and then that has to be justified in somehow in the engineering that you do.
Let's try now working out something, brainstorming something useful to the listeners. Let's say someone approaches you in your elevator ride to the 50th floor of your headquarters, and they tell you that wood is stronger than steel in fire, or they drop this one of these cliche arguments that you see wherever a wooden building is being built, that charring layer magic, the fire resistance period is enough, wood is stronger than concrete, lighter than concrete. You know, all these arguments that come online all the time. What would you say to such a person to cut the discussion, give a healthy dose of doubt about that, but not destroy the enthusiasm? Because I ultimately think I don't want to be seen, or I don't want us fire engineers to be seen as the guys who ruined the party, and everyone is excited about wood and people would like living in a wooden skyscrapers. I would like to live in, it's beautiful, it's nice, it smells nice. My laboratory after delivery of CLT smells beautiful, which is not very often for a fire laboratory.
Yeah.
So I don't want to ruin the party, but also I don't want to push people into another Grenfell type of scenario where we realize there is an issue after multiple people die, or the losses are so tremendous it becomes obvious, you know? So let's brainstorm a good 60-second answer to someone. What do you think?
Well, I'm not sure if I can do it in 60 seconds, but it's funny that you... I'll come back to the 60 seconds, but just it's funny that you mentioned the elevator ride, because that scenario happens to me a lot when I read students' work. Obviously, they also pick up the excitement about timber, and it doesn't even start at fire. They will say, timber is stronger than steel. And then I forget to say its strength to weight ratio might be close to what steel can give you, or even better. But that doesn't mean it's stronger than steel, because strong is a material point and steel is stronger than timber. We don't have to argue about that. So that's one thing people tend to forget, and that going back to the 60 seconds and the example of fire is really the main argument people say is that like, fire affects all materials. They say timber buckles, concrete spalls, and timber burns. They kind of try to create this false equivalency between these. Because buckling is a structure response. And I've seen a lot of timber structure buckle, but that isn't an argument to rule one out or the other. And really, you have to treat all three materials not the same, because they pose different challenges in the built environment. So with timber, this is something that you discussed with Danny. The first issue is the fire dynamics. And then in terms of structural capacity, there's different things, because with steel and concrete, we know much more about it because we've had big fires in massive steel and concrete buildings. And in some instances, we have learned very painful lessons from that. The World Trade Center comes to mind. So yes, these can fail on fire, but we have learned these lessons. We have protective measures we can take. Therefore, we can build them maybe with a bit more confidence. And we probably had big fires in timber buildings, because you said we have big timber buildings in Japan. But if you actually go to Japan and you look at these timber buildings, there will always be a little information booklet next to it, and it will say burnt down in 1789 and rebuilt. So these things happen, okay. And they tend to destroy the whole building. So yeah, and it's really about understanding material, knowing the limitations, and dealing with it in a responsible way. I love working with timber. I've helped some of my colleagues do some concrete casts for their PhD. And it's terrible. You need so many people. It's messy with timber. I mean, ideally, you have a good relationship with the manufacturer. You get it pre-sawn to your site, and all you have to do is put it in your rig and start. So as a researcher, I love timber, and I love seeing it in buildings. But I also want people to treat it with the respect it deserves. And the thing that annoys me most is when I see these articles in the newspaper where people just gloss over it with these arguments that timber is slow to ignite. That's not the point. It's not the ignition that's the issue. The issue is when it starts to burn and then won't stop to burn. So all these things that we are not currently considering. I mean, another thing that we haven't even fully touched upon is what happens after the fire. We don't even fully know in terms of how much strength is recovered when the timber cools. How much more strength does it lose after the fire when either the temperatures continue or the moisture content increases again? Because it is a material that has an equilibrium moisture content, so it will lose, and you get adsorption and loss of moisture with a change in temperature. There's all these unanswered questions.
So maybe a good answer would be that fires in compartments for all types of structure would look more or less the same, would have very similar challenges, but the difference is that after the contents burn down, the fire of timber structure may continue, and it poses a completely new world of challenges which were not explored in large buildings built with non-combustible materials yet. And I guess these are the ones that we worry the most about.
Yes, exactly. Also, I guess the way we assess the suitability of building materials, because, I mean, I know there's a lot of discussion about the fire resistance framework. I don't really want to go into detail on that because that's not the topic of this episode. But in the end, the timber, when you test them in fire resistance in a furnace, and I know you have done some work on that, the fuel consumption is completely different. So are you subjecting them to the same conditions, the same temperature conditions, but is it a fair test to use different fuel between them? And what does that mean for the application in the real life?
Yeah, we have raised that concern also in a paper at a workshop that John Gales organized like 2 or 3 years ago. We've took statistics from like, I don't know, 300 fire tests done with different types of materials, like incombustible, combustible materials. The most interesting were fire doors, you know, because fire doors are fairly small elements. There's possibly three technologies that you can build it. It's either steel with some sandwich material inside insulation, or it's either aluminum frame and fire-resistant glazing or some boards inside them, or they're wooden. That's three prevalent technologies you would have for doors. And even on such a small sample, you could observe the change in fire dynamics of your furnace. In short words, the fire of the tested element, when it caught fire, the tested element, it was almost enough to sustain the standard fire conditions in the furnace. So the fire in the furnace is self-sustaining, which is kind of worrisome when you think about the purpose of fire testing. And you get into this discussion with fundamental fire testing researchers who focus on the equivalency of fire resistance tests and stuff like that. And it's only based on temperature comparison at your plate thermometers. That's pretty much equivalency, that the exposure conditions to which your sample was exposed were equivalent among these tests. And if you consider only that measure, yeah, that's true. The temperatures in the furnace were very similar between these tests. But I'm not very comfortable with the fact that my furnace behaved in a completely different manner between one and another. And I would love to open this discussion in the fire community, because I think this is a discussion that needs to be taken. Because the fact that we, fire engineers, understand this nuance difference between these tests, maybe not even all fire engineers, maybe just a group of fire engineers and researchers understands that, but it's a small nuance in the test. But in my opinion, makes a large difference. But to an outsider, to an architect, to a structural engineer who's not a fire safety engineer, it says 2 hours fire resistance, period. And my concrete has 2 hours fire resistance. My steel has 2 hours fire resistance. My timber element has 2 hours resistance. To me, they are all the same in terms of how will they behave in fire, because the number is the same. And this is dangerous for us, fire people, because if there is a huge fire in the timber building, and there will be a huge fire in the timber building, that's not a matter of if, but when. And the timber was designed to have 2 hours of fire resistance. It will be on us. Why it didn't resist fire for 2 hours? Because you fire people told us it resists fire for 2 hours.
Yeah, and I think you pick up on a very important point there, is that you have these numbers, and that's, you always see that 90 minutes, 120 minutes, and that's where people that might not be from the fire community, like structural engineers or architects, they hold on to these numbers. And that is for them the justification that, like, okay, if that's the way that works, fire resistance, this is the same number, so I might as well use the timber. But then obviously, like you said, you have the fuel contribution even from a small door. So now scale that up to a whole compartment clad in timber. Then there's the other issues that if you test, for example, a CLT slab, things like the char fall off delamination, that can all happen in the fire resistance test, doesn't change anything for the outcome. Or the charring rate will increase a bit, but you do not capture the effects of the longer fire dynamics that you would see in a real fire.
Not every fire test is load-bearing as well. But that's why I've invited you to this show, you know, to show the complexity of the problem and where the engineering in that truly is beyond just the 7 mil safety layer, because there is so much more to that. And I think obviously people will not know how to engineer timber from just this podcast, but I hope they will have a little better understanding where the problem and engineering is and what can be done, what cannot be done, what are the choices. So I'm really happy to have had this discussion with you. Where are you heading now? What are you going to do? Because I know you have some really exciting projects in this regard in the future. So what people should look forward from you? And you know, there is high expectancies from your side, because Luke once said that if you want to read a good exemplar research paper, read one from Viesmo. Mm-hmm. So there's high expectations from the fire community towards you now.
Yeah. Well, I guess he had to say that, seeing that he works a lot with me, and I think he was referring mostly to graphics or plots that I do. So that's mean the actual papers.
Which are fantastic.
In terms of what I do right now, I mean, I'm actually still working on some of the analysis from my doctoral studies. So that's on the structural fire space. Then actually here in Australia at the University of Queensland, my research is going slightly different direction, and I'm looking a lot about the interaction of durability, design life, and fire safety of timber. That means how can we use fire retardants to increase not only structural performance, but fire performance in general of timber. But also one of the things we're looking at is, so you can use treatments to increase the durability. How do they interact with the fire safety? Of course, your silver bullet would be a treatment or design method that both increases fire safety and durability, but that's obviously needs research. We're looking at flammability and suitability of new timber species in terms of how can we use them, which timber species can we use in wildfire-prone regions. Yeah, so I'm definitely looking a bit more on the flammability side, because during my doctoral studies, I really focused on the structure and I measured the temperatures, but I didn't care that much about the dynamics and the flammability. And now I'm looking more into that and I'm actually learning a lot, which is very interesting, and turning into a proper fire dynamics nerd. And a mobility, mobility guy. Yeah,
that's a lot of research, but it sounds really exciting.
It is overwhelming because one thing I realized as a PhD student, you have it good because you have your topic and you focus on that and you might pick up a thing or two on the side. But once you get into a more of a research phase where someone pays you a lot of money to come up with ideas and research, you're kind of managing a lot. Like nothing is really in depth. Oh, you work with your students and they are the creators and they really bring all the creativity in and you kind of try to guide them. And some days I still get to work in the laboratory, which is nice. Yeah, because although if I spent like a week in the laboratory, I'm happy to just sit on my desk with a tea or coffee. And if I spend 2 weeks in the office, I just want to be in the laboratory again.
I'm really happy that this shift in your career happens for you and there is so much more you can do now having these resources, students, and great collaborations. And this complexity of your future research plan is a great testament to the complexity of the problem. So yeah, Felix, thanks so much for taking the invite to the show. And yeah, man, cheers. We'll pick up this interesting talk in the future for sure.
I'm sure it will stay with us, and I think there's a lot of exciting research and development happening across the world. I mean, there's so many working groups now working on this, so I think we're hopefully heading in the right direction. And like you said, we have to make sure that we take people along with us in that conversation. Architects, structural engineers, we have to have patience, I guess. Not always easy, but yeah. Thank you very much for having me on here, and hopefully it will be helpful.
Thanks, Felix. That was a really great chat, and I'm very happy to have you on the show with this non-easy subject of structural fire resistance of timber structures. I really enjoyed when Felix explained to me the role of moisture transport in wooden products or in timber in general. And that's something I have never thought about, that it may play such a critical role. And then again, when you think about connections or the glue lines and parts of the structure that you could consider weakest link, weakening them through this mechanism seems like a potentially quite dangerous problem, and I'm happy that someone is working on solving this. I also hope you've enjoyed how Felix shown us the role of the structure of the cross-laminated timber elements, the role of using proper sizes of lamella, the influence of different adhesives. That's really fascinating that you can engineer this product to such a degree. And yet on the market, people just drop it down into mass timber or CLT, and I will not lie, I did as well. Whereas this is a family of solutions, not just one of them. And if there are so many things you can change to improve the product, it means we got some tools to work with. And yeah, I really hope Felix's research goes into developing new solutions for CLT safety, and it will truly allow us to make this leap towards sustainable development and use of mass timber in built environment. So once again, thank you for listening to this podcast episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. For the next week, I'm going to experiment a bit. I have recently been on a very interesting conference, International Water Mist Association conference that was held in Warsaw. And I've learned a lot about water mist. And I've actually chased some people with microphone. It was my first conference coverage as a journalist, if I may. And it was quite fun. I really enjoyed the conference. I really enjoyed talking to people on the side. I have some thoughts about the research and technologies shown on the conference. And I will bring it all to you next Wednesday. So yeah, I hope you're looking forward to that. Anyway, thanks for being here, and as usually, see you next Wednesday. Cheers. This was the Fire Science Show. Thank you for listening, and see you soon.